Edward P. Jones, the author of The Known World. The book is Jones's first novel, and he won the Pulitzer for it. His latest book is a collection of stories called All Aunt Hager's Children, which is set in the black communities of Washington, D.C. Please welcome Edward P. Jones. Welcome.
Thank you.
So when you hear your work read aloud or performed, do you take it in differently than when you read it?
It's rare that I hear someone else reading my work. And it's as if I can step back and appreciate it in a different way. It's almost as if I want to shake the hand of the person who wrote it.
Do you have, as this Anna Deavere Smith screenplay works its way toward completion, do you have a dream director, dream actors in mind for this film?
No, I don't. I wrote the book, and the book is itself, but everything after that is in a different world, and I never even have one thought about anything beyond that.
Really?
No.
Even though you're a movie, I understand you're a big movie lover.
But if it were someone else's book, I might have a lot of ideas. But because it's mine, I don't.
For The Known World, did you pile on the research?
No, did no research.
Literally no research?
No.
The language, you just sort of figured that's how they talked in
Well,
Virginia?
Before the idea even came to me, in the 60s, I had read, for example, the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, other novels. Then Roots came along in the 70s. So in the early 90s, when the idea for the novel did come to me, I had a sense of what the world looked like back then, you know, and small things. People aren't walking around with Rolexes. Large things, people had to guide themselves at night with the moon.
But the census figures that you cite, and actually there's a scholarly work you cite, that's all just out of your head.
When I knew that I wasn't going to use a real county and that I had to rely on my imagination and make my own, I had to come up with things that a reader would believe in. And I started with the census. And along the way, I added imaginary historical books about this particular place.
This book, this novel, brought a lot of attention to this little-known fact that there were black people who owned, free black people who owned slaves. Did you get any, was that a controversial decision after the book came out and brought all this attention? Were there people who thought, oh, God, I wish he would have kept this under the rug?
No, and I've heard that from maybe two or three people, but those were people who had not read the book. And once they did read the book, the response was very different, I must say.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I understand you worked full-time for many years for a magazine, a trade magazine called Tax Notes. And even after your success with your first book of stories, which received awards and lots of attention, how did you have the time? One can imagine a short story, but how did you have the time having this full-time journalistic job doing The Known World?
Well, I was essentially summarizing newspaper and magazine articles on taxes. And I was working at home. I've been working at home since 86, so I could arrange my day the way I wanted. And that meant when I wanted to write, when I needed to write, I could get up in the morning and do that and do the dry stuff in the afternoon and evening.
And was there a point at which you felt, okay, the world is taking note of me, my books are selling, I can quit this day job?
No, I was working at Tax Notes after Lost in the City came out. And when I finally decided it was time to work on The Known World, I took 5 weeks of vacation. And 2 weeks into the vacation, they fired me after 19 years. After 19 years of working there, and they gave me 2 months severance. When Lost in the City came out, when I was interviewed, I never once hesitated to tell them where I was working. After The Known World came out, I never hesitated to tell people what they had done to me.
Good for you. And I don't suppose you read tax notes these days.
Goodness, no. That's an esoteric thing for tax accountants and lawyers, for those nerds. And I'm a nerd, but I'm not one of them.
You're a different flavor of nerd, I guess. Would you read from one of your stories, the one called Tapestry?
Yes. This is about 1932-33, and this couple is newly married and leaving the new wife's home. Just before the train with the newly married couple left Mississippi, it stopped at a patch of a place so small no one had bothered to give it a name. The entire train was full, and that first cabin, which got most of the smoke and soot from the engine, had only colored people. George, the sleeping car porter, who had worked most of the trip to Washington. Anne, settling into being Mrs. Carter, got to know many of her neighbors in her cabin. No one in that first leg of the trip, save her and George, was destined for lives in Washington. The other future Washingtonians were picked up along the way, farther north in Mississippi, and then in places east, especially St. Louis. At that patch of nowhere in Mississippi, three colored people got off, and a pregnant Negro woman and a white man got on. They were married, though none of the Negroes knew that. Instantly, there rose in their hearts a disdain for the white man and a you poth put upon thang attitude for the woman, who was some 7 or 8 months in the family way. They waited for the white man to leave, perhaps to go to one of the cars for whites, or, more likely, to leave the train altogether. After all, he had had his pleasure. But he followed the woman to a seat 2 down and across from Anne. He stored 2 suitcases above the seat. When she was seated, he helped the woman take off her shawl and folded it and made a pillow for her head. Then he knelt, unhooked her shoes, and began to massage her stocking feet. The Negroes could see that they were not yet 30. The train's engines snorted right and left, shimmied, and then started up. In 5 blinks of Anne's eyes, it was on its way. The seat of the Negro woman, accompanied by the white man, was facing Anne, who saw the woman with her head still leaning back, her eyes closed as the man worked her feet in his hands. The Negroes around the couple, some standing, some sitting, were silent, and they, all but the smallest children, looked at one another. Maybe he was not really white. He took a pair of yellow slippers from his coat pocket and put them on the woman's feet. He stood and took off his hat and nodded to just about every Negro head in the car, and then he removed his coat. The man took the seat at the window beside the woman and disappeared from Anne's view. The Negro woman's head was still back, and she opened her eyes before long and smiled at the older couple in the seats facing hers and the white man's. And she looked at the white man and smiled. The oldest person in the car, the woman of the couple facing the Negro woman and the white man, asked them in a voice many heard, "Y'all going far?" The pregnant woman nodded and smiled some more. "Yes, ma'am." They knew he was white when the conductor came in 20 minutes later and said in a loud voice, in a voice white people had for each other when they knew one was making a mistake in the presence of Negroes, "You sure you this where you want to be?" "I'm sure," the white man said. Many of the adults in the car would live to see the first man on the moon, and a good bunch of those would never believe it had happened. That scene with the white man and the Negro woman was far more incredible. But those who believed would do so because the scene on the train had come to them unfiltered, without the use of some camera operated by the space people out to try to trick their eyes.
That is Edward P. Jones reading from his story, Tapestry. Most of your stories are somewhere, broadly speaking, in the middle of the 20th century, most of them set in Washington, D.C. Is that a matter of the old dictum of writers should write what they know?
No, when an idea for something comes to me, it's almost always in the 50s or the 60s. I think because that's when I was coming of age, the world became more and more colorful. I can't really imagine stories for the most part in the 80s or 90s. There was a great deal of life that I was discovering in the 50s and 60s. And whenever I see a woman walking down the street, she's almost walking in a 1950s dress.
You are now an international literary superstar. I told me a few minutes ago you just got back from Milan. How has it been going so quickly from the very little known tax writer in Washington to being this great big literary celebrity?
It's been very nice. But up until recently, I tried to just, you know, live the kind of simple life that I had, because there is a danger, of course, that you become the person who did not write the books. And so up until recently, when it started getting hot in Washington, I would get out with my suitcase if I was going somewhere and catch the bus at my apartment building and go to the Red Line, which would take me to the Blue Line to the airport. And I would get on the plane and do the same thing coming back. I didn't leave my apartment with a cape, with an entourage. It was just me and my suitcase. And it'll be like that forever.
So you think keeping it real is a matter of willed achievement?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a comment made by some guy. I forget his name now. He was in that Pimp movie. He was up for the Academy Award, and he was interviewed on Nightline. And he said that fame and fortune doesn't change people. It just unmasks them. And I think that's true.
Edward P. Jones, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Edward P. Jones is the author of All Aunt Hagar's Children and The Known World. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. We are at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. And in a minute, we may make some men in the audience a bit uncomfortable. All you mama's boys know who you are. That is the title of a song coming up from Elizabeth and the Catapult in just a minute. Stay with us.